Welcome back to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. A 2014 study by University of California, Berkeley researchers found that about 30% of bank tellers nationwide receive public assistance, including food stamps, Medicaid, and direct welfare payments. In New York, nearly 40% of tellers' families are on benefits. Nationwide, bank tellers earn between $11 and $15 an hour, and at that pay level, many, not only in this sector but beyond, are food insecure. What was once a stopgap measure to help with food insecurity, the public-private partnership of food banks and other programs has developed into the hunger industrial complex that is perpetuating poverty, not helping it. Andy Fisher, who's worked in the anti-hunger field for 20 years, discusses this problem in his new book, Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. It's published by MIT Press. Andy Fisher, welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you for being here. Now, you tell an instructive story in the introduction about your family's move from New York to Youngstown, Ohio in 1958. Why did they move there?
My dad was a physician. So both of my parents were born in New York City. My mom was an immigrant from Lithuania, and they met in New York, and they moved a couple places. He moved up to Syracuse. My dad did his residency, and then he got a job in Youngstown. So we all, it was before I was born, but he packed up the family and moved to Ohio.
Yeah, I was about to ask, were you even born then? That's actually 60 years ago this year.
Yeah. No, I'm not quite that old.
So what was it like growing up in Youngstown, Ohio?
At the time, Youngstown was a pretty prosperous, it wasn't exactly the most culturally progressive community in the world, but, it's a fairly prosperous place. It was very blue collar. A lot of folks worked in the steel mills or at the auto assembly plant, and, they earned a decent living, middle class jobs and sending their kids to college and going on vacation. So it was a place that was, that was doing okay. It was doing okay. Until about 1977, until 1981, when the bottom fell out of the steel industry, and the town really just went down pretty fast.
Right, that anticipates what I was going to ask, because in the 1960s, like many cities, Youngstown, Ohio, had to deal with civil unrest over income inequality, racism. Black Monday happened in Youngstown in 1977. What event is marked by Black Monday?
So Black Monday is when Youngstown Sheet and Tube, which was one of the major employers in Youngstown, one of the major steel industries, decided to close up shop. So it laid off quite a lot of people. So that was kind of the warning bell for the city. Mm-hmm. Of when the steel industry began to fall apart.
And then by the early 1980s, Youngstown lost, 40,000 manufacturing jobs?
Yeah, Youngstown lost about 40,000 manufacturing jobs, and not just manufacturing jobs, but the jobs that were of people who are, earning an income from those folks who were working in the steel mills, the auxiliary sectors. And the town lost about 60% of its population, and I think it peaked in the late 50s, I believe, early 60s, at about 160,000, and it soon went down to about 60,000 or so.
And what was happening in Youngstown wasn't sort of isolated to Youngstown, right? Places like Detroit, Cleveland, Dayton, Gary, Flint, they all went through this.
Right. This was the beginning of what we now call the Rust Belt. Mm-hmm. At that point, those were all thriving industrial centers of the steel industry, the auto industry, or of other kind of manufacturing sectors. And in the early 80s, a lot of those industries and a lot of those towns really suffered some pretty hard times.
And what was President Reagan's response?
President Reagan's response was not adequate. There wasn't a lot of effort to bring jobs back into Youngstown. He came in, and in the early 80s, there's also a deep recession that happened at the time, and cut back social service programs such as the food stamp program. So we saw kind of almost a perfect storm of high unemployment combined with a decrease in federal benefits.
And was there no one, take us back to that time. How is it possible with everything that was happening in all Youngstown, Detroit, Cleveland, Dayton, Gary, Flynn, with all of these big social economic impacts hitting these cities and towns in the country, that the Reagan administration thought it wise to cut back on social services?
Yeah, you know, I'm not a great political historian, so I don't know the discussions that were going on within the Reagan administration. But you know, my sense is that Reagan came in with an ideological agenda of reducing the scope of government.
Right.
And with kind of some old tropes about people who are on welfare and becoming dependent, and kind of the welfare queen driving in a Cadillac kind of you know. Trope, I guess, would be the best way to call that. And so the ideology was that, you know, they needed, things needed to be privatized, the market needed to take its course, and it wasn't the government's role to be playing favorites or to be, or to be supporting the poor.
Now, you write about the United Steelworkers locals who in Pittsburgh began to work closely with the Hunger Action Coalition to create a rapidly growing network of food pantries. Talk about when that happened.
So this was around the same time. You know, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Youngstown were all heavy steel industry towns. They're all, you know, some of the major steel producers in the country. We all, you know, all three of those towns went through some pretty hard times. So around the same time, in the early 80s, the steel workers union saw, as it did in many other places in Pittsburgh, as in many other places, that their members were suffering some really hard times. They were laid off or fired, essentially, because the steel industry closed. So they saw, you know, a huge amount of need among their members. So what they did is they organized food banks. They organized food pantries to serve those members with parcels of food so they could continue to be able to feed their families. And that's something that, has morphed and taken off into a very thriving food bank industry.
Yeah, I was going to ask, was what happened in Pittsburgh with this work with the Hunger Action Coalition, was this meant to be, at the time, a long-term solution or just an emergency response?
No, it was really an emergency response. And, you know, there were a number of food banks. You know, the first food bank came into existence in the late 60s, and then there were a handful or so in the 1970s. But with the recession of the early 80s and the cutbacks in the food stamp program, we saw a dramatic increase in the number of food banks taking place around the country. And if you talk to folks who were involved during that time period, they will tell you that, you know, that their work was not intended to perdure forever. It wasn't mm-hmm. It wasn't meant to be a long-term solution. It was a response to a social emergency. And, you know, it was called the emergency food system, as if it was something that would only exist for a few years until we could get past this economic and these political hurdles. But as we've seen, that has not been the case.
I'm speaking with Andy Fisher, author of Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Andy, you write that, and you write, quote, "Today, Youngstown seems to top all the negative indices. Some have called it the most vanishing city in America. The Brookings Institute noted that it has the most concentrated poverty in the United States, with almost 50% of its population in poverty in 2011. Andy, wasn't Youngstown ranked as the most miserable metropolitan area in 2013? And this was due to its income levels, violent crime rates, poor rates of education, educational attainment, high unemployment, and population shrinkage. All of that combined to give Youngstown this very dubious distinction?
That's correct. And unfortunately, what's happened in Youngstown is what's happened in many other places. I mean, Detroit's another great example in which those who could afford to leave the city left for the suburbs, essentially white flight. So it's left the city with a shrinking population, with a population that is almost exclusively low income. And, it's left the city with a lot of, it's left the city with a lot of empty lots, essentially. A lot of houses that are abandoned.
So a lot of houses that are abandoned, but then that brings to mind what kinds of jobs are available for the people who weren't able to leave Youngstown today.
Yeah, and what you see is, you know, you see, you know, here and there, Youngstown's tried over the years has tried economic development over the years, and it's, you know, there's a car assembly plant, a GM assembly plant outside the town that has continued to thrive for the most part. It's brought in a private prison. You know, fracking has been big in that area and has led to a little bit of resurgence of a little bit of economic development in the area. You know, obviously at a cost of earthquakes and harm to the groundwater, but that's been a boon to the area. I think, you know, what we see as well is a lot of resentment. You know, we see the kids that I went to school with back in the 70s, you know, their parents, again, had middle-class jobs and were working the steel mills and had a boat and went on vacation and the like. And now you see those kids who are my age now in their 50s and their kids who are resentful, who are perhaps working at Walmart making $10 or $12 an hour, or working at the private prison as a guard, or unemployed, or finding other jobs perhaps in the service sector. So I think that has led to a lot of resentment that we see all across the Rust Belt, and, you know, in which in some cases, you know, I think you can trace back to Trump's election. You know,
right.
The county that I grew up in, Trumbull County, which is just north of Youngstown. It literally grew up on the border of Youngstown and the township above it. And that county had always voted blue, had always voted Democratic. And for the first time since Nixon, it voted for Republican. It voted for Trump. And I think that's an indicator of the, you know, the lingering resentment and the economic distress of that community.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm glad you brought up the political changes in the area, because it made me wonder, how do the folks in that area view government these days? Do they want government to come in and help be a part of the solution, or have they completely given up on government?
You know, that's a great question. I don't think I'm really, you know, really that qualified to answer that. I haven't been in Youngstown in a couple of years, so I don't know exactly, you know, where people are thinking these days. But there's, you know, I think there's always been a lingering resentment, a lingering suspicion. I also think that, you know, what we in the nonprofit world, especially in the anti-hunger community, have told them, the solutions that we provided them have been either, you know, federal nutrition programs such as the SNAP, or which is Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which, you know, used to be known as the food stamp program, or we provide them with charity, with food banks. And those are solutions that are both stigmatizing and solutions that, you know, don't confer people the dignity of being able to make a living, a decent, just living like their parents or their grandparents were able to do.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Andy Fisher about his book, Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. Later on in the show, João Moreira Salles with his latest documentary about revolutions and uprisings around the world, plus filmmakers Tom Myers and Dennis Doros talk about where the film industry flourished for a decade before Hollywood, in Fort Lee. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. Welcome back to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Our guest today, Andy Fisher, author of Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. Andy, let's talk about food insecurity. We know that our nation right now is facing the greatest income inequality since the Gilded Age. Isn't income inequality at the heart of food insecurity?
Absolutely. You know, people who are food insecure or hungry, you know, which I think is kind of in the popular vernacular, slight difference, but you know, they're hungry because they're poor, because they're in poverty, or because they don't have money to access enough food, which, you know, really, you know, is an indicator of, you know, and has been, well, food insecurity has been entrenched over the past 20 years, as has income inequality. So we see, as you mentioned, a growing income inequality in this country, and we see a persistent food insecurity, despite the fact that the economy has improved dramatically in the past 6 or 7 years. And you see food insecurity is still at over 12% in 2016, whereas when we started measuring it in 1995, it was at 12%. So we haven't made any progress on food security writ large over that 20-year span.
Right. And you mentioned earlier, I believe, that the lowest wage sectors of our economy are the fastest growing, right?
Correct. And they tend to be the service sector. The food industry in particular is one of the lowest paid, I think the lowest paid sector in the economy.
And you also mentioned the unchanged rates of food insecurity being at about 12%. Now, is that a result of stagnating wages?
Yeah, it is. You know, I should say that, you know, the SNAP program, food banks have all done, as have other federal programs, have all done a huge amount to reduce food insecurity. It would be a lot worse if it weren't for those programs. So it's not that those programs aren't working, it's that their scope is limited. You know, the minimum wage peaked in terms of its purchasing power in 1968. If it kept up with inflation and if it kept up with productivity, it would be at over $18 an hour. So we see, you know, a federal minimum wage of 7.25, probably, I don't know what it is in New York State, but here in Portland, it's around $10 or $11 an hour. So we see it well under that level. We also see that somebody can work now. What's different now from what, say, 20 or 30 years ago is that you have a lot more working poor among the ranks of the food insecure. You have people who are working full-time at a $10 an hour job, and they're still able to qualify for food stamps. They're still having to rely on food pantries if they're in a family of two or a family of three. So you don't have, you know, work doesn't necessarily equate to getting yourself out of poverty or being able to feed yourself these days.
Right, and since we're talking about, you mentioned the minimum wage. A lot of progressives are pushing the idea of a $15 minimum wage. A lot of municipalities have adopted this, actually by statute, adopted a $15 minimum wage. How much would that ease food insecurity across the country if that became the federal minimum wage policy?
I think that would, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it would be an enormous boon. You would see a large number of people who would no longer have to rely on food banks or have to rely on the SNAP program. You know, in a place in like New York where rents are so high, or here in Portland where rents are high but not quite as high, you know, $15 an hour isn't the end-all be-all, but it's a great starting point. So it's going to, you know, the more money people have in their pocket, the more they're going to have flexibility to be able to buy the food that they need.
Mm-hmm. You know, Andy, major metropolitan regions are, they're all facing shortages of affordable housing. I mean, that's what's happening here in New York City. How much does that contribute to food insecurity?
That's huge. Absolutely. I mean, in many places, such as New York or Los Angeles, where I used to live, you know, people are spending 2/3 of their income on rent. Rents are outrageous, or they're doubling up or tripling or quadrupling up in a place to be able to afford it. Affordable housing is, you know, perhaps the number one factor that drives food insecurity, along with medical bills. You know, medical bills are one thing that drive people into bankruptcy, but affordable housing is absolutely essential if we're going to be able to address food insecurity.
Mm-hmm. As I said in the introduction, banks and much of corporate America underpay their workers, and then the federal government has to step in with social services, which are rarely enough, as we've discussed. So they are further subsidized by charitable programs. What's the logic, Andy, behind this? Isn't a livable wage a better approach for corporations? Why underpay workers?
Well, take a look at Walmart. You know, I think Walmart is kind of a great example of this. Walmart there's a study that just came out in Ohio, actually, by a group called Policy Matters Ohio, that found that 13.5% of Walmart workers are receiving SNAP, are receiving food stamps. So if you start doing the math on that and you extrapolate that nationally, you realize that that Walmart workers and their households are taking in about $600 million worth of SNAP benefits every year. That's $600 million that Walmart does not have to pay its workers. It just goes into its pockets. You know, there was a similar study that was done in 2014 that looked at the pantheon of federal programs and found that Walmart employees were costing taxpayers over $6 billion a year when you factor in Medicaid and SNAP and housing, affordable housing vouchers. So So Walmart is able to line its pockets with the money that it doesn't have to pay its workers by encouraging them to go to food banks and encouraging them to get onto food stamps. So it becomes an income support program, becomes a profit support program, essentially, for big business.
Now, Andy, don't corporations receive tax breaks for giving to hunger organizations?
They do. I mean, corporations obviously receive a tax break for any of its philanthropic donations.
Right.
So, you know, they'd be able to write it off. But they also get a tax. The food industry also gets a tax write-off for donating food to food banks. About $200 million a year is what the Congressional Budget Office estimates in those tax breaks.
Well, I'm asking that because I'm wondering if the corporations receive better tax breaks for giving to hunger organizations than they would for paying a livable wage.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's where you see, again, you know, Walmart, again, is a very easy example. You see a company like that is gaming the system. They're not paying their workers enough. They're giving, you know, they committed over $2.5 billion worth of food and cash to anti-hunger groups for which they receive tax write-offs. But the linchpin in this is that they use that philanthropy to gain access into urban markets, to gain access into places like New York City and Boston and Seattle, from which they've been shut out, and to buy the neutrality of those anti-hunger groups, and also to get a lot of earned media. You know, every time Walmart donates $50,000 to the food bank in El Paso or Kansas City or wherever, you know, there's an article in the local paper about it, and it
right.
makes them seem like the good guy rather than, you know, a hunger fighter rather than a hunger causer.
I'm speaking with Andy Fisher about his book, Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. Okay, so Andy, why haven't anti-hunger advocates decided, or not why haven't, why have they, anti-hunger advocates, decided to ally themselves with corporate America? How are they doing that?
Yeah, I think part of it is the urgency, is the immediate nature of hunger. You know, hunger is a problem that needs to be solved today. You can't tell somebody who doesn't have food, you know, wait 3 years or 5 years until we solve the root causes of this problem. You know, people need to eat today. So there's an immediacy to the problem. Anti-hunger groups, I feel, have mortgaged the future. They've made bargains with the devil, with corporations who are with whom it makes it more difficult to address the long-term solutions by solving the problem for today. So that's, you know, that's the trade-off that gets made is, you know, they need to solve the problem for today, so they mortgage tomorrow.
And so, well, then how do anti-hunger advocates feel about that particular critique of yours of what they're doing?
You know, I think it varies. I think there are some that take umbrage at that analysis, and there are some who are more progressive and who are really trying to change the way they're doing business and accept it. I mean, the food bank community, you know, there's 200 food banks in this country. They serve 46 million people, 60,000 food pantries. They're very split. You know, there are some, such as City Harvest, such as Westside Campaign Against Hunger, who are very progressive and are really trying to address the root causes of the issues. And there are some that are a little bit more entrenched and see their job as just moving food from point A to point B, and, you know, don't want anything to get into that in the way of that. So it's a field that is very much in flux, that is being disrupted in many ways, and that is in great transition. And that transition, in many ways, is very exciting because you see some new approaches and some really interesting new work happening in a lot of food banks around the country.
Yeah, and those stats that you cited are from your book. In that paragraph, you say that, you know, the 200-plus food banks and the approximately 60,000 food pantries and soup kitchens that distribute $5 billion worth of food every year in virtually every corner of America are a tribute to the astonishing ingenuity and dedication of the American spirit.
Absolutely. You know, there's 80 to 100 million people who donate food at any one point in this country, at any one point in a year in this country. There's millions of volunteers who are volunteering at the local food pantry or food bank. I mean, I think, you know, I think there's something to celebrate there. I don't want to be all negative about it. I think there's something that's very positive about that. You know, we are a generous people. We see the need among your community. Hunger is very much a bipartisan issue, which is unique these days, and something to be valued and celebrated. But you know, that, I'll leave it at that. There's something very valuable at that.
Well, you know, I was particularly surprised by one stat in your book. You write about the Second Harvest Food Bank of the Mahoning Valley serving a 3-county area around Youngstown that boasts that it served 7,916,667 meals in 2014. That's an astonishing number.
You know, nationally, Feeding America, which is the hub for food banks around the country, reports that last year it served throughout the entire country 4 billion meals a year, 4 billion meals in 2016. So it's become, you know, an enormous amount of food. It's become, you know, a way of very established and entrenched secondary institution mm-hmm. for the way poor people are accessing food.
Do you think the continued expansion of the charitable food system is a national paradox in that it both assists those in poverty and perpetuates it?
Exactly. I think that's a great point. You know, the food banks measure their success in terms of the pounds of food that they distribute and the amount of people that they serve. And typically they have growth goals. So typically they will say, we're trying to distribute 5% more food this year than we did last year. It's kind of a corporate revenue model.
Right.
In which growth is necessary for success. So that, to me, that growth is not a measure of success, but a measure of failure. It's a measure of the fact that food banks are not reducing poverty, are not reducing the amount of people who are coming to their door in the first place, who need their services. I mean, their services are not inherently good. They're a necessary evil. What food banks need to be doing is what they call shorten the line, reduce the number of people who are in the line rather than feeding the need. But at the same point, you know, you can't stop because there are so many people who are needy and who are struggling with food insecurity mm-hmm. and need the food today. So food bankers very much struggle with this need to address the root causes, but the urgency of people coming to their door for whom they don't necessarily have enough food.
Well, once again, Andy, you've anticipated another question of mine, which was I was going to ask you if you worry that the anti-hunger groups continue to protect and expand their food charity in isolation from the necessary long-term approaches that are needed to actually end the work that they do.
That's a fantastic point. And that, I think, is kind of the crux of my argument around food banking. And that is that when charity, all it does is address the immediate need without addressing the long-term solutions, it's kicking the can down the road. It's perpetuating the problem. It turns into a perpetual poverty machine, as Peter Buffett writes about.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are, again, you know, this is an issue that is very much front and center in the brains of organizations like Feeding America and many of the food banks, the third of the food banks that are kind of a bit more on the progressive side. They're very much grappling with that issue, and how do they do both at the same time, and how is it not a zero-sum game when they take money to do policy advocacy, when they take money to do community development work? Are they taking food out of the mouths of people because they're not right. putting that money into their distribution system? And so grappling with that paradox, I think, is very much something that they're all struggling with currently.
Yeah, because you write that anti-hunger leaders don't see themselves as part of a larger struggle either to bring back good-paying jobs or even be actively involved in helping to increase the minimum wage. Is that because they view their work in isolation to these bigger issues, or it's too complicated for them to get involved with because of the urgent, pressing need of right now of people in hunger?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on both counts. I mean, I was just I just did a talk in Colorado Springs last week, and the chief operating officer of the local food bank was there on a panel with me, and you know, she said that we cannot be everywhere, we cannot do everything. We need to specialize, and we specialize in moving food. We're not experts in healthcare or affordable housing or wages, so we don't get into that. I don't agree with that. I think they can certainly, you know, join alliances with folks that are. But I think that that kind of specialization is paramount in the nonprofit world these days.
Mm-hmm.
It's nonprofits focusing on their mission, on a very narrow mission, rather than seeing themselves as part of a broader social movement against poverty or against income inequality. I think that's, you know, one of the really critical problems with the way nonprofit community is structured these days.
Yeah, Andy, you got to talk about the Community Food Security Coalition.
Sure.
That's an organization you founded, right?
Yes.
Do I have that right?
Yeah. I co-founded the Community Food Security Coalition with a couple other folks from Hartford and from Los Angeles back in 1994. It was founded around the Farm Bill that took place in 1996. And it was an effort to bring together people from disparate fields but related to food, hunger, sustainable agriculture, gardening, farmers markets, and an effort to say that there is a coherent ideology, there's a coherent theme, and they have a coherent set of interests because, you know, we're for marginalized consumers and marginalized farmers, and that benefiting local food systems will also benefit the nutrition and food access. So that coalition lasted for about 18 years. I ran it for 17 of those 18 years. Unfortunately, it did go under, but it was the precursor, really, to what we see nowadays as the food movement. You know, we really were kind of helped accelerate and build the movement to what it is today.
Well, let me press you in the little time that we have left. So your organization lasted 18 years. Why did it go under?
You know, it was a challenging situation. I left the organization in 2011. My board and I had a falling out. And then the board took over and just was not able to keep the fundraising going. So mm-hmm. It was very much kind of internal politics and internal capacity issues rather than anything in the world that made it unnecessary or the like. It was just kind of a failure of it was a case study of a nonprofit failure.
Uh-huh. And so then to close out, what can and should be done differently, do you think, to deal with hunger in America?
I think, you know, as long as we're talking about food banking, you know, one thing that we need to do is to be shrinking food banking. We need to be moving to a place where in a decade or two where those growth goals are no longer in place, but we actively make strategic plans movement-wide to shrink the scope of food banking. And not that that means that there's going to be more people who are food insecure or poor, but that we're shifting those resources into upstream causes, into addressing the root causes of food insecurity. We need to be organizing volunteers. We need to be putting the $85 billion of federal food programs, which we didn't really get into, finding ways to redirect that money to reduce poverty and reduce income inequality and to make the food system more democratic. You know, there's a number of things along those lines that we're moving into. I think a lot of those are very structural in nature.
Andy Fisher is the author of Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. Andy, thank you very much for being on the show today.
My pleasure. Thank you, John.
Coming up, João Moreira Salles with his latest documentary about revolutions and uprisings around the world. And later, we'll look at the recent arrests of volunteers who are leaving water at the Arizona-Mexico border. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break.